It appears generally what he targeted was thin-billed brunette females.
Anchorage police arrest a soldier they say committed multiple rapes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists discover a prehistoric marine reptile fossil in Southeast.
From anything outside of China, this is the only full specimen that exists, which is really exciting for us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Anchorage police have arrested a 25-year-old soldier, Tony Earl Bullock Jr., for a series of sexual assaults at gunpoint. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
John Vandervalk is a detective with the Anchorage Police Department Special Victims Unit. He says Tony Earl Bullock Jr. allegedly targeted brunette women with similar features.
It appears generally what he targeted was thin-billed brunette females in the 18 to 35-year-old group. Two were native, one was a white female, but they all have similar features.
Vandervalk says Bullock has been in the Army for about 2.5 years and is stationed at Fort Richardson. The first alleged sexual assault occurred at approximately 4:20 a.m. on July 16th. The very next day, police say Bullock abducted another young woman around 6:30 p.m. on Bragaw Street. The victims in these two events completed composite drawings that were extremely similar. They were released to the public and multiple tips were received. July 20th was a turning point in the case, Vandervalk says. That's when a patrol officer noticed a person matching the description in the cases following a lone female on foot at around 3 a.m. in the Mountain View neighborhood. The officer identified him as Bullock.
That one was probably a sexual assault that was narrowly averted by sharp patrol officer who noticed him following a female in a suspicious manner in the middle of the night and took action and interrupted the event before it occurred.
That's when Bullock became a person of interest in the case. Then on August 11th, at approximately 4:30 a.m., a native female called 911 to report that a black male had just attempted to rape her.
In the last event that was only an attempt, the victim was able to retain her cell phone and immediately report to APD.
She provided a license plate number for the vehicle the suspect drove away in, and the vehicle was Bullock's. She was also able to positively ID him. He denied assaulting the woman, but admitted to meeting her on the streets of Mountain View. On Tuesday, APD served multiple search warrants for locations that Bullock used as residences, including his barracks room at Fort Richardson, and recovered more evidence. The APD partnered with the U.S. Army in their investigation. The suspect was apprehended, investigators emphasize, because of the bravery of the victims.
All three of those women immediately reported the events right after the event. This enabled the police to secure the crime scene and recover the critical evidence that is there.
Vandervalk says investigators believe there may be additional victims.
Four events that APD can be certain that he is involved with over about a 3.5-week period. That leads me to believe as an investigator that he may be involved in other events.
According to a spokesman for U.S. Army Alaska, Bullock had been a specialist assigned to the 2nd Engineer Brigade at Fort Richardson since March of 2012. His specialty, repairing small firearms. That was his first main duty assignment. He joined the Army in February 2011. The APD is asking anyone who may have been assaulted by Bullock to report it to police. Bullock was scheduled to be arraigned at the Anchorage jail Wednesday afternoon. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A young man is in critical condition after being beaten in an abandoned building in downtown Anchorage. About 8:30 on Monday night, someone slid a handwritten note under the door of the University of Alaska Police Department in Eugene Short Hall. The unsigned note tipped police off that someone was being held against their will in an abandoned building in downtown Anchorage. Campus police handed the case off to the Anchorage Police Department. They went to the building on Barrow Street in the Fairview neighborhood and found a badly beaten young man. Police say he was carrying an ID but is still unconscious. They hope to verify his identity soon. No arrests have been made, but police are asking for help from the public to solve the case. The mass shooting at a Navy installation in Washington, D.C. on Monday is reigniting the debate over guns and background checks. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the Alaska congressional delegation is not predicting any movement.
Both Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich voted against an amendment that would have required background checks for guns sold at gun shows. That amendment, called Manchin-Toomey after the amendment's authors, failed in the spring. Joe Manchin is a West Virginia Democrat who once took heat for a campaign ad that showed him shooting a hole through a climate change bill. And Pat Toomey is a Republican from Pennsylvania with an A rating from the NRA. So when the bipartisan effort went down, gun control advocates lost momentum. Manchin says he wants the amendment on the Senate floor again. He wants another vote, saying it failed last time because opponents dubbed it gun control, something he disagrees with.
It's basically background checks, which we call gun sense. And it says strictly, simply, that commercial transactions should have background checks without any loopholes so we know if a person is qualified or should have a gun if they don't have a criminal past or they've been adjudicated mentally. I mean, these are things we should know.
It's unclear whether Monday's suspected killer, Navy contractor Aaron Alexis, had ever been involuntarily committed. He reportedly suffered from mental illness for years. The FBI says Alexis was able to purchase a shotgun in Virginia. Neither Murkowski nor Begich say guns are the problem. They say mental health is the only issue. Begich has a limited bill that he says would force states to better report criminals to a federal database of people prohibited from owning guns.
Well, this gentleman had nothing. He wasn't convicted of anything.
Begich says nothing has changed his opposition to expanding background checks to gun shows and internet sales. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he will not bring any mental health bill to the floor without the background check provision. He says he's continued to lobby senators for their support since the amendment failed.
I talk to people consistently, and the thing that bothers me is a number of Republicans say, yeah, we know you're right, but we can't do anything about it.
Murkowski says she has not talked to anyone about guns since the issue failed last time, and any new talk will not change any laws.
I think that the voting is done. I don't think that the debate is done.
But a debate in Congress without a vote doesn't amount to much of anything. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
This year's permanent fund dividend is
$900.
Acting Revenue Commissioner Angela Rodal made the announcement this morning, beating expectations that checks would be even smaller than last year. On top of hearing how much the state would pay out to its residents, reporters also got an update on the state of the permanent fund. With the big number out of the way, APRN's Alexander Gutierrez walks us through the other ones.
So let's start with the biggest one.
$640,436.
That's how many Alaskans should get a check deposited into their bank accounts or sent out to them on October 3rd. It's a smaller pool of applicants than last year, even though Alaska's population is growing. Commissioner Angela Rodal attributes that to more aggressive fraud investigations and maybe smaller dividend checks in recent years. Which brings us to
2009.
That's the year that tripped everything up, shrinking checks from four figures to three. Dividends are calculated by taking the income that the Permanent Fund Corporation earned over the last 5 years and averaging it out. In 2009, the corporation lost money, a lot of it, when the bottom dropped out of the global economy. The stock market has since made a rebound, and so has the Permanent Fund. The fund now has
$45 billion
in the bank. That's a $5 billion increase over last year, which means next year's checks should go up too and break the $1,000 mark. But even though this check is one of the smaller ones in recent history, Alaskans still made
$2.5 million
in charitable contributions through PicClickGive, which lets recipients give a chunk or all of their PFDs to nonprofit groups. It was a record year for the program, with about 26,000 Alaskans giving to 400 different organizations across the state. Okay, so now that we've made it through figures of the millions and billions, let's get to something smaller.
$36,000. $343.
That's how much you've received from the state's permanent fund over the years if you've been collecting a dividend since the program started. The next number is even smaller, but still impressively big in its own way.
108.
That's how many birthdays the oldest PFD recipient has celebrated. The youngest applicant was a newborn, who was just 1 minute old when the calendar year ended. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a prominent Native journalist is the new Atwood Chair at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
People have not only a right, but an obligation to tell their own stories and to make sure that it's not filtered through other people like my eyes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The REAA school board election is October 1st. Polls are open 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the register, you may vote a question ballot. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Pacific walrus are gathering on the northwest coast of Alaska, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has begun procedures to keep airplanes out of the area. The agency says it's also urging nearby residents to avoid actions that could cause stampedes. The World Wildlife Fund estimates 2,000 to 4,000 walrus are on a beach near Point Lay in the Inupiaq Eskimo community, 700 miles northwest of Anchorage. Female walrus and their young each summer rest on the edge of sea ice. The edge moves north as ice melts. With climate warming, sea ice in recent years has melted far below shallow Chukchi Sea waters where walrus can dive for clams. Instead of riding the ice, they gather on shore. More than 20,000 animals were counted in 2011. The Alaska Board of Fish has a work session planned for October 9th through the 11th in Girdwood. And although it's not on the agenda to talk about Kuskokwim Chinook salmon, that's just what several local groups want the board to do. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The board considered Kuskokwim area issues in a meeting in January. Now, the Bering Sea Fishermen's Association and local tribes are asking the board to take up Kuskokwim king salmon out of its normal cycle. In the request, the Fishermen's Association says it's concerned with the management of the run and wants conservation measures put in place. It questions the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's decision to use a new model for this year's escapement goals. The new model lowered the escapement goals by tens of thousands of fish, but still, the goals were not met. In fact, escapements were the lowest in history. Karen Gillis is the executive director of the Fishermen's Association.
The model that they used really hasn't been reviewed by anyone outside of the department, and we really had worked pretty hard along with the Association of Village Council Presidents to at least have a chance at reviewing the data and the model development itself, and that still hasn't been done.
The Association of Village Council Presidents represents 56 tribes in the region and most villages along the Kuskokwim River. AVCP also questioned the lower escapement goals before they were implemented and now supports the board reevaluating the management. Some individual tribes have come forward asking the board to take up the issue.
There's no fish. There's no fish escaping.
Lisa Fireison is the tribal administrator in Tuathbluk, located on the middle Kuskokwim River. She says the tribal administration surveyed residents this summer to see how their subsistence fishing season was going. They found out it wasn't going well. Residents were sometimes drifting dozens of times for just a few kings.
And so as a voluntary conservation effort, we in Tuathbluk, we realized there was no Chinook escaping. We all asked them to voluntarily not fish for Chinook and just put up reds and dogs because there just wasn't any Chinook coming up here.
Fireison and Gillis both stress that the problem isn't an upriver, downriver one, and they don't want that kind of conflict. Fireison says conservation measures need to happen now before the start of next year's fishing season so that residents can get used to them. And perhaps the Board of Fish, when they meet next month, will take one step closer to making that happen. The comment deadline for the board's work session is September the 25th. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The fossil of a thalattosaur discovered near Cake 2 years ago is a complete specimen, the first to be found in the Western Hemisphere. Scientists speculate it could be a new species of the prehistoric marine reptile. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
The fossil was found along the shores of Kikyu Island near Cake the summer of 2011. It was excavated in two rock slabs from a ledge with the hope they would reveal a complete thalassosaur, a marine reptile that inhabited the seas 210 million years ago. The rocks were stored at the University of Alaska Museum of the North in Fairbanks. It wasn't until earlier this year that Earth Sciences curator Pat Druckenmiller got a fossil preparator to work on them.
We knew that we had sort of the tail end of the animal and it was going into the rock, but we didn't know like how far in it went or if we had all of it. And when he came up, we said, well, let's just start cleaning in this area here where we think roughly the skull might be. And bingo, it was right on top of the skull.
In the next week, fossil preparator J.P. Cavagelli from Wyoming worked to uncover about half of the skull. All under a microscope, Cavagelli used handheld jackhammers and a small hand blaster to do his work.
It's fairly tricky because the rock and the bone are almost the same color, so it's a very subtle change, which is why you have to do it all under the microscope. So by the time you get the last layer of rock off with the sandblasting outfit, it's hard to see unless you know what to look for.
Cavagelli has prepared various fossils, but this one is unlike any he's encountered before.
I've never done anything Triassic. I've never done such a complete small animal like that. I should say I've done some fishes, but fishes, a fish. This is a reptile, much more exciting.
It was like an iguana. It basically had the ability more than likely to come in and out of the surf and feed, and it was about 3 feet in length.
Tongass National Forest geologist Jim Bechtol was part of a group that discovered the thalassosaur fossil more than 2 years ago.
From anything outside of China, this is the only full specimen that exists, which is really exciting for us. It's a key thing in the evolution of this branch of marine reptile.
Bechtol says pieces of fossilized thalassosaur bones had been discovered in Southeast Alaska before, but never a complete specimen.
The thalassosaur that we just recently discovered must have floated down quietly to the bottom of the ocean and laid there. Didn't come tumbling down and disarticulate and break apart.
Museum of the North curator Druckenmiller says having a complete skeleton this well-preserved allows more to be discovered about the thalassosaur.
First impressions from what we can see of the parts that we have cleaned suggest that this is unlike any other thalassosaur that's known from, say, Europe or China. It's very likely we may have a new species.
Bechtol describes further.
All of the thalassosaurs that have been discovered have teeth all the way out to the end of their rostrum or their nose or their jaws, and the one that we have actually has no teeth out near the end at all.
Druckenmiller says Cavagelli will be back this winter to uncover the rest of the fossil. He hopes there's evidence of where the skin or body outline used to be.
The other thing that would be entirely possible on a skeleton this well-preserved is actually to preserve stomach contents and to get direct evidence of diet. And for an animal like this that we know really very little about and that has such strange skull and teeth, that would be really, really important information.
Once the specimen is cleaned up, Druckenmiller will start comparing it to other thalassosaurs. If it is indeed a new species, Druckenmiller, Bechtel, and others involved will get to come up with a new name for it. Druckenmiller says the fossil will be displayed at the Museum of the North. Bechtel hopes a cast of the thalassosaur will make its way back to Southeast Alaska, where residents can enjoy a fossil that came out of rocks from their own backyard. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A A former lawmaker caught in a federal corruption probe of Alaska politicians has lost a chance to have his bribery conviction overturned. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on Tuesday issued an order saying none of its judges thought Vic Coring should have a rehearing before the full court. He had pleaded guilty in 2011 to conspiracy to commit bribery, but later he claimed the federal prosecutors withheld information from his attorneys. A two-judge panel declined to intervene, but Coring asked the full court to weigh in. Coring wrote the appeal himself after his three public defenders in Seattle withdrew from the case following the ruling from the two-judge panel. Coring is currently running for a seat on the Wasilla City Council. Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson has paid a $21,000 fine to the EPA for a series of hazardous waste management violations in 2010 and 11. According to EPA Enforcement and Compliance Officer Sean Yu Chu, the violations included failure to conduct weekly inspections of hazardous waste facilities and containers for leakage or deterioration, failure to ensure staff participated in annual hazardous waste management training, and failure to submit a hazardous waste tracking report. She says J-Bear's settlement with the EPA addresses each of those issues.
They have agreed to ensure that the weekly inspections are performed, and they also provide a documentation which certifies that their staff are all up to date on their hazardous waste training. And as well as they've submitted the hazardous waste tracking reports that was missing from the inspections.
The facility cited in the violations generates and stores hazardous waste from vehicles, aircraft, and other facility maintenance. No J-Bear officials were available for comment by airtime. This year's University of Alaska Anchorage Journalism Department's Atwood Chair is a man who has covered Alaska stories in the past. A member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe of Idaho, Mark Trahant, is the first Native journalist to hold the position. Trahant has been covering federal budget cuts, the Affordable Care Act, and the impact of both on tribes. He says he wants to encourage more Native people to become reporters.
I mean, that's top of my list. I think it's essential. People have not only a right, but an obligation to tell their own stories and to make sure that it's not filtered through other people like my eyes. And so that's certainly part of it. Other than that, I've been really lucky. I've been coming up here on news stories for really 3 decades. And so this is kind of, it just fit in a lot of ways for me.
Talk a little bit about some of those stories that you've worked on that have brought you to Alaska in the past.
Sure. Well, the first was the Exxon Valdez, and I was at the Arizona Republic and had one of the really great jobs in journalism. It was to cover the West, and I kind of defined whatever the West was going to be, so it stretched from Louisiana to Alaska. And I remember at the time thinking I didn't want to get into the gunk of following hundreds of reporters, so I waited 4 weeks until after the cleanup had occurred. And then I picked 5 different communities and went and did profiles and tried to tell the story that way. But I waited till it all kind of started to filter out and people got back to normal life. And that's when I highlighted it. I came up to work on a film for Frontline on abuse in the Native community. And that was one of those stories where I hadn't written a lot about it over the years. And when it first came up, I thought, I really don't want to do this. And I'm just so glad that I did, because I had my eyes opened and just met some really remarkable, resilient people.
You mentioned earlier that Native people have not only a right, but an obligation to tell their stories. How do you see that in the larger context of journalism, and what non-Native journalists should be doing in that respect? Because there's oftentimes a healthy debate about who should be covering what stories and how.
I think what's essential for non-Native journalists is just to hang out. It's so often it's a crisis-type story. They're dropped in. They're trying to learn everything at once. And that's a recipe for what I call the X factor. The truth plus X equals news. And X can, from geometry, can be anything.
And the less time you have just to hang out and absorb and learn, the less time you have to get the story right. So when there's nothing going on, that's when you should be hanging out with people and learning.
What do you think are the most pressing issues facing Alaska Native people today in our state?
Certainly, having an impact at the polls would be a big one. Governance issues. Some of the governance issues are just starting. For example, what portends with changes in the Arctic Sea? And did ANCSA settle those claims that are offshore? Does that start it all over again? I mean, it raises all kinds of very interesting questions, not to mention the governance issues involving what it's going to impact. Just opening of shipping lanes in the Arctic Sea could impact Native communities in really extraordinary ways.
The Interior Department has allowed Alaska Native corporations to have a seat at the table in certain talks about development, and some of the tribes have expressed a lot of concern about this being kind of a slippery slope in giving a corporation that type of authority that a tribe is normally reserved for tribes. What are your thoughts about how that does or should work?
I think that's really an open question. In the lower 48, the way the Indian Reorganization Act works is that a lot of tribes are both corporations and governments, and they try to act as enterprises. My tribe, for example, the Shoshone-Bannock, have hotels and a casino and do things as a government and as a corporation, and that has its own set of problems. So I think it's going to have to be figured out. I don't think there's a straight answer. It's going to take negotiations. It's going to take some experiments. It's probably going to take some practice and failure.
Mark Trahant is the Atwood Chair of Journalism for UAA. A longer version of this interview is at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.